Hi, this is Layla Johnson of Community Rights Groundwork. In April of this year, 2016, I had the pleasure of speaking in Bangor, Maine, to a group of people who had passed in 13 communities there a local food and community self-governance ordinance. Their success with this ordinance has led to the consideration at the state level of an amendment to the Maine state constitution to protect the rights of people to local food and to local self-governance. The following is the address that I gave at the conference there. I talk about the connection between food, freedom, and authentic local democracy, as well as the need for us to shift our culturally held views on conflict away from the notion that conflict is something to be avoided, and rather to a perspective that conflict is the only way that we will ever all authentically have our needs met. Thanks to everyone who organized this event. We're dedicating ourselves to the work of asserting the rights of people, creating a vibrant local food economy, and defending and defining our rights to make the laws that represent our vision for our communities. So just to give you a little more background so that you know who I am and where I'm coming from, my involvement with local lawmaking and confronting systems of power that don't allow for citizen participation started about 3 years ago when I took a workshop, a three-day-long workshop, essentially a democracy school, with a man named Paul Cienfuegos. And the topic was, it's called community rights. The larger movement was framed to me as community rights, kind of like civil rights or women's rights, community rights. And the basis of that is that we have a right to make laws about the things that affect us, and that essentially democracy is something that we do. It's not something that we get or have or can be given to us. It's an action that we participate in and we actively create. And the effect on me of this work was astonishing. Previous to encountering those ideas, I'd had a really averse relationship with politics because something about the way that news represents our interactions with government and the political discussions are framed just always seemed wrong to me. I never wanted to hear it. And when I heard this message of community rights about our fundamental rights and about the necessity of our participation in democracy and the need for a fundamental resurgence of that, I felt for the first time like a sane person, that I hadn't been, off in my own world in delusion, that I had been feeling something really true inside of myself. So since then, I've been really excited about this work. I spend almost every day, several hours of every day, talking about, thinking about, engaging with this work mentally. And it's totally changed my attitude towards the issues that are threatening our world and our communities, because our world is really just made up of small communities here and there. And instead of feeling hopeless and powerless, and that the problems are too big for us, and that we need to put pressure on powerful people somewhere else to do something for us, now I realize that we are the power holders. We are the people that don't need to ask. We just have to act. And for the last year, out of that conviction, I've been working with a group of wonderful people to build this support organization, Community Rights Groundwork, where we seek to support communities and citizen groups in passing rights to local self-governance ordinances, but also, because this is very crucial, helping them develop the interpersonal and cultural skills and habits that make self-governance possible. Since democracy is something we do, we have to learn some tools and skills in order to make it happen. So I've also been, because of my involvement with that and my inner interest, I've been paying a lot closer attention than ever before in my life to political discussions. But I'm still mostly uninterested in conversations about big national elections and behind closed door trade deals and all of this. I notice more the tone of the conversations that I hear among people. People are very cynical about business as usual in politics. People are ready to hear something different. People are having new ideas about how we might do something. And people are ready to try new things all over our country. As the world becomes more and more out of control, we're growing in our sense of political agency, and all of us striving individually for empowerment, for the power to do something, we're coming together in our communities as a real body politic. We're ready to do something. But through my lens of involvement with community rights, I've come to realize that not all the things we can do are created equal, and that democracy is much, much more than fair elections and the ability to vote without being shot at. It's important that we engage this political agency in ways that truly represent and manifest our power and don't give it away to systems that thrive off of our disenfranchisement and our apathy. Another current that I notice is that while we're ready to act, we're ready to do something different, we're also inexperienced in wielding our power, and we're a little bit afraid. So a couple of the main points where that fear comes up are when existing systems of government push back on us, you know, when we start saying we have rights and they start saying, no, you don't. We think to ourselves, did I break the law? Am I doing something wrong? Am I going to get in trouble? And these are people that we've been told are very powerful and, you know, this relationship is difficult. We also are afraid of the difficult conversations that we have to have locally. It's sometimes difficult for us to show up to a town meeting and state our case calmly and with strength. It's difficult to talk to a neighbor who might disagree with us. We have a difficult relationship to conflict. But that relationship to conflict is a growing pain. It's a sign that we're pushing our edge. And truly confronting the issues at hand is what needs to be done. That's the task that we're assigned with. In my perspective, drawing out the points of conflict is at the root of what local rights-based lawmaking does, and it's the source of its power. It exposes the conflict between government's power, people's power, industry power, corporate lobbyist power, etc. When we make laws, when we start the conversation, we have a conversation on our own terms, and we have a different conversation, one that revolves around who has the right to make decisions about where we live. And as we engage in that conflict, we practice the skills of statesmanship that will ultimately allow us to step into our full and rightful inheritance of local self-governing citizens. At its root, governance is accomplished through difficult conversations, hearing viewpoints that are different from our own, considering clearly the situation, and coming to the best solutions that we possibly can. Governance is about taking conflicts and transforming them into solutions. So I'm really happy to be here today with all of you, because your local food and community self-governance ordinances do a lot of these things. They define not only your outward vision for your community, but they also define the rights that you know you have to make the changes necessary in order to secure your vision. You're not just passing a resolution that says, please, we would like. You're passing a law that says, please, we would like, and this is the method of how. You're focusing on your real power as citizens of your community. You're focusing on your responsibility to each other and your interdependence. And you're embodying the truth that we provide for ourselves and we decide for ourselves are two sides of the same coin. So in the time that we have together today, I would just like to discuss the basic mandate of democracy for us to be the authors of our political destiny. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the beautiful vision that we have for a local food and political system. And I'd like to discuss the transformational nature of conflict, which will help us to but not only enact and maintain our laws, but will also be the foundation of a more democratic future. So many of you have worked hard to pass the ordinances in your municipalities, or you're working hard to do the same. And I'm sure that because of that work, we share a great deal of common understanding about the political basis of our efforts. But just to ground ourselves today, at the very beginning of our time together in this shared reality, I'd like to speak out loud some of the understandings that I have, some of the foundational documents and ideas that create our government, that really define the position of strength that we're coming from when we do this work and, you know, validate the struggle that we're engaging in. It's important because when we engage in conflict, we really do have to be clear about what our most deeply held values and inviolable principles are. We have to know where we're coming from. So in a democracy, the idea is that the citizens are sovereign. I'd like to add to that that in my understanding, it's not that each of us has the power of a king, not each of us as individuals, but that that power of kings is shared equally without discrimination among every one of the citizens. So all of us collectively are the king. This is those are slightly different things, so I wanted to be clear about framing that. Because of that sovereignty, because of that shared power, government is instituted by us for our protection. We can see clearly that our sovereignty multiplies when we work together, and to create the world we want to see, we bind together into a social contract, which we call government. There are words to that effect at the very beginning of the state constitution of Maine, saying, we the people of Maine, in order to establish justice, ensure tranquility, provide for our mutual defense, promote our common welfare, and to secure to ourselves and to our posterity the blessings of liberty, we do agree to form ourselves into a free and independent state, and we do ordain and establish the following constitution for the government of the same. Powerful language. It's we the people. That's where that power comes from. Not a king, not a religious authority, not somewhere else, not the Senate, not special class of people, we. Because that government is instituted by us and for us, we have the right not only to create, but also to define the terms of our government. Article 1, Section 2 of the Maine State Constitution states that explicitly. It says, power inherent in people, period. All power is inherent in the people. All free governments are founded in their authority and instituted for their benefit. They have, therefore, an unalienable and indefeasible right to institute government and to alter, reform, or totally change the same when their safety and happiness require it. Very clear. That's the adopted state of Maine constitution. That's a law. And so, with all that behind us, here we are, heirs to a great experiment in self-determination and democracy. The nation that we live in was founded on the common sense notion that authority belongs to the local people where they live and not distant authorities. I suspect, and I see and experience, that because of a lot of the deceptive framing of politics and news over the years and the consolidation of power into the hands of the wealthy, that the lesson and the promise and the practice of democracy have not been fully integrated into our awareness and into our culture. The task at hand is nothing less than living up to the truly revolutionary words at the heart of the founding documents of our government. Thomas Jefferson said it very clearly in the Declaration of Independence. This is the last governmental quote that I'll read for you, but it's one of my favorites. Thomas Jefferson writes, as he hands his article of his Declaration of Independence to the king to say, no more will we engage in this abusive relationship. He says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their creator, internal, with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them, the people, shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Living up to this huge promise and this huge task requires fundamentally shifting our understanding of our relationship to power. We're used to power coming from somewhere outside ourselves, from laws raining down on us. We need to realize that the power comes from us. We need to feel that in ourselves and understand that government is our agent, but that we are the principals. Whatever power government has comes from us. We give it through our consent, and we can take it away. We have that right. Our government works for us, or it doesn't work at all. So, since sovereignty is the operative part of food sovereignty, what we're really talking about here is claiming our authority to govern ourselves. And so we naturally come in this discussion about governance to the nature of laws and lawmaking and to the origin and power of laws. In our modern world, we mostly perceive that laws are words written on paper or something we can look up on a website, something we can read. Additionally, we usually understand them as coming from somewhere on high. And we also have sort of a magical relationship with laws where we assume that just because they are written or just because they have been decreed, that now suddenly the world has changed. We have a sort of magical relationship where we don't understand that laws are actually a human creation that is intended to represent reality. They are not actually part of reality itself. They're a human creation. And also, an older and deeper understanding of the human creation of laws is that laws are essentially agreements that we enter into as a society or as a culture or as a community or a tribe, and that these agreements dictate our behavior and make life predictable. Laws at their root represent social norms that allow for structure and safety. For more on that topic, I recommend the work of Val Napoleon and her doctoral research on indigenous law. So now we have to turn to the idea of, once we talked about laws, we talk about just laws and unjust laws. So just laws, right laws, preserve the order that best allow for the community to meet its needs. We don't have a problem with just law. We obey them easily because they make sense to our hearts. They're clear to us. To invoke the sentiment of Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter from a Birmingham jail, we have a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Just laws tend to come from the people that the law is applied to, tend to come organically from the culture of the people. That is, the people who are in relationship with each other naturally come to some agreements and some balance about how to best collect, allocate, and execute the distribution of various resources. That's essentially what our government does and what laws do. And then, once we've entered into these agreements, they make sense to us because we've all come to them together. There's also an understanding that when laws are imposed from the outside, and when they don't make sense, and when they don't serve us, that's probably because they've come from an outside perspective that doesn't really understand our community or our culture or our vision for what our safety and happiness looks like. That outside authority doesn't have a real stake in the allocation of our resources or in the preservation of those resources, and in some case, very obviously, has a stake in taking those resources from our communities. And so this orientation is the source of injustice and unjust law. And to go back to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we also have a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. And so here, for me, is the kernel of truth that emerges from between the lines of our founding documents. It's the truth that I believe is reaching for the air at this time in our world. The truth is that where current structures of law do not protect our common well-being as we perceive it, where the laws even confound our best efforts to steward our land, conserve our water, and thrive in our livelihoods, these structures of law are illegitimate and unjust, and deserve neither our obedience nor our fear. So what excites me so much about the ordinance that you folks have developed, which is something I've not seen before in the larger community rights movement, and the potential that these laws have for real transformation, is that the power to supply ourselves with food is also the means by which political power is won. Food sovereignty is almost the same as sovereignty itself. There's a lot of examples from history, and I'll run through a few of them in a very cursory way. In the early 15th century, when the English colonization of the New World was beginning, new laws were enacted from on high that allowed the aristocracy, the people who owned the land, had the deeds, to enclose their property. And what enclosure did was kick the commoners off the land. Commoners who had been living for their entire remembered existence off the land, from the land, with the land. And they were homeless. And then these homeless people became the laborers of the new economic system that was growing up around colonization and capitalism. And these homeless people, who were found to be in violation of enclosure, this new law that was created, those people who were still providing for themselves from the land in violation of law, were punished brutally, either hung publicly or dismembered publicly or drowned publicly or put into brutal prisons. And the reason for that is that aristocrats and power holders were truly afraid of the power of a landed people. A more modern example comes to us from the incredible struggle of the populists of the 1860s to take control of grain pricing and the transportation thereof. These patriots organized themselves around the inherent power of their production of food. They were ultimately branded as rebels, and their gatherings were brutally subdued. Many people were murdered. And finally, many years later, after the dust had settled, the Dust Bowl came through, and the descendants of the populists were removed from their land by big banks and large agribusiness concerns during the environmental crisis of the 30s, as well as the Great Depression economic crisis. Another example is that in the Revolutionary War that created our independence from the British were able to control the coastal cities because so much food was coming in from the sea, but they were never, ever able to take root in the countryside because of the inherent power of people who can make their own food. Another reason for the bitterness of the British-American conflict was that the British Empire needed the control of the colonies in order to ensure a market for their global mercantile system. They needed colonists to buy their tea from India in order to make the merchant class rich, and the early patriots deeply understood that. So they dumped that foreign tea in the ocean and started brewing their own local tea. I personally think that the Grocery Manufacturers Association is in a very similar position when we start growing our own food, and what you guys are doing here is as important and revolutionary as the Boston Tea Party. Additionally, and on a personal level, quality food is necessary to maintain the healthy bodies and minds that can participate in a democratic system. If we are all sick and tuned out and unable to show up, we can't have a functioning democracy. We also need our democracy to protect our food sovereignty and our food freedom. They are inextricably linked. So not only is food necessary for freedom, but the concepts that have been used for a long time now to support local economies of food sufficiency are virtually identical to the concepts that support a local origin of political authority. In a local food and political system, accountability is very simple and direct. On a national and industrial scale, we need regulations. They make sense because in the industrial food system, you know, milk from thousands of cows is mixed together. Food is sometimes harvested by machines or worse, by disadvantaged people who have no stake in safety, who are being abused themselves. There's a need for accountability at that level and inspection. But if there's a problem in the local food supply, you can immediately identify the source and fix it. You can talk to the person that you got your food from. And the same is true with politics. How can you fix a problem on the local level? You're going to go to Washington and talk to someone for a few minutes? We don't have the power to do that. That power is way over there, far away from us. On a local level of politics, that person might be our neighbor. We can have a discussion with them. We can deal with that problem because it's immediate to us. Local food is also more nutritious and wholesome because it doesn't travel for thousands of miles. And it's the same with politics. Our national politicians are full of shit, just like the industrial food, because they don't have to look us in the face. They're too busy traveling all over the country, seeking the approval of power holders at the heads of enormous institutions. Local food's also more efficient. We don't expend our precious resources transferring it from one side of the country to the other. And local governance is more efficient in that we are able to respond to our particular and specific issues without lots of back and forth between us and distant representatives who may or might not even understand the culture or context of our issues. Local food and local political systems also foster local uniqueness. Every bioregion and community has its own character and should have its own food and flavors and its own social contracts and its own cultural politics. There's no one-size-fits-all answer. The days of, you know, making our country look exactly the same from coast to coast are over. Doesn't work. A local food and local political system also provides meaningful work that allows us to be part of creation. As human beings, we have a deep need to be involved, a deep need to create meaning for ourselves. And when we can be involved with the food that we eat to maintain our lives and the decisions that our communities make to maintain our livelihoods, we gain the kind of satisfaction that makes life truly beautiful. And so, lest this task seems too large and overwhelming, you're not alone in this struggle. There are over 200 other communities in this country who have passed similar ordinances asserting their rights to local self-governance. Many of them have worked with CELDEF, and many of them have worked to stop corporate trespass or government overreach. In Pennsylvania, they were defending their right to a rural way of life, and they banned CAFOs. Here in Maine, people defended the right to water and banned a huge Nestle water bottling facility. In Pennsylvania, they also defended their right to water to ban fracking, same in Mora County, New Mexico. In Missouri, I'm working with some folks who are working to preserve their right to a local agricultural economy and stop the building of a huge high-voltage transmission line, turning their community into a sacrifice zone. There are hundreds of communities around the country doing this work, engaging with this work, making the necessary changes. So I want to take a moment, because what we're really doing here in this movement is confronting systems of law that make what we're trying to do here illegal, and they exist. In many states, there's things like Dillon's Law, which is sort of the opposite of home rule, which says that the relationship of a community's government to its state government is the relationship of a child to its parent, and that the state can decide at any time that the community has been naughty and has not done its chores or overstepping its allowable actions, and can either, you know, take the law off the books or can completely dismantle the government, the local government. In other states, there's state preemption and regulatory law, which is interesting in this situation. And I'd just like to say a few words before we move any further about regulatory agencies and about regulatory law, because in essence, the local food and community self-governance laws that you're passing have as their primary opposition the Department of Agriculture, which is a regulatory agency. So many of you in this room have had experiences that make this very clear, but I just would like to speak it out loud so that we can share in our agreement that it's easy to assume from the outside and from the beginning and from what we learn in civics classes that regulatory law is an example of just law because it's there to protect us. There's this prevalent story that regulatory laws are put in place to protect the people from dangerous levels of pollutants in the air and toxins in the water and bacteria in the food and medicines that might make you more sick, et cetera, et cetera. And they seem to have laws aimed at the regulation of industry action. But there's some suspicious things that go on in regulatory agencies. One, first thing, biggest red flag to me, is that regulatory agencies frequently have as their directors people who have long and successful careers in the industries that they report to regulate. Industry influences also seem to have a much easier time getting regulations strengthened or loosened when compared to citizen activists who are trying to do the same thing. And it's the same thing with enforcement. At regulatory hearings, are regularly chaired by appointed officials who are not elected by the people and are not accountable to the people, and there's no legal obligation of any kind for those agencies to respond to or make decisions based on the things that they hear from the public at those hearings. It's a gripe session. They collect them, they put them in a binder, and they file them away, never to be seen again. I'm aware of the situation here in Maine where the state legislature has passed laws encouraging the active support of small local producers, and yet meanwhile the Department of Agriculture is creating regulations that make it more difficult for small local producers to thrive. Very suspicious. And so all of these things, you know, make us think that naturally what we need to do is take back the regulatory agencies, since of course they exist to protect us. But I'd like to draw your attention to read at another time, but if you're interested in exploring this more, you received, when you checked in, an article by a woman named Jane Ann Morris. It's called Sheep in Wolf's Clothing, And it is the history taken from primary documents on the founding of the regulatory agencies, the first regulatory agency being the Interstate Commerce Commission regulating the railroads. And, you know, lest we give ourselves a hard time about it, our confusion is warranted because since the brain trust and a lot of funding for regulatory agencies come from corporate industry, they've got the best media, advertising, and marketing teams that money can buy, and their campaigns that what they're doing is to protect us are very convincing. So it's not all just our confusion. There's a reason why we think that. So given that we're up against huge bodies of law and, you know, this regulatory system and decades and decades and decades of dysfunctional governance, it's likely that our assertion of our right to govern ourselves and to make these kinds of laws at the local level will be met with resistance. We should expect that. So what do we do? Well, given our grounding in historical evidence and the validity and legitimacy and reality of our power, we choose to confront this pivotal and transformative moment in our history. We see an opportunity to speak up for ourselves and to represent ourselves and to create actively a world that matches what we're hoping for. And that is what the local food and community self-governance ordinance catalyzes us around. That is the action that it calls us to do. So the first few questions of resistance that we're likely to hear as we engage in the work of community self-governance are two. One, is this legal? And two, well, what if we all decide to start breaking laws and starting new laws? To answer the question, is this legal? The short answer is, from my perspective, is that those with power get to decide the law, and so legal is not the same as right and wrong. I understand that here in Maine you have a very strong home rule position, and that there are other state laws, like the legislation that I mentioned before, that support what your ordinances represent. But I'd like to add to this conversation that even if something catastrophic were to happen and those things were to be taken away, like in Wisconsin when our governor said communities don't have the right to ban frac sand mining, if something like that were to happen, people were to get in control of the governor or the Senate or wherever, and the laws you were writing suddenly did become outright illegal, I would argue that the decision to make those laws illegal would be illegitimate, and the validity of your ordinances would remain, be unchanged, and that the need to defend them and to continue obeying them would be even more immediate. So then to turn to the question of, well, what if we all decide to start breaking the law? What if we all, you know, set up our own little kingdoms and declare sovereignty from our country? As we've discussed, there's an inherent community and social nature to law. We don't exist individually. We exist together. I believe that some of the response of some of the people, like the people in Oregon, have been sensationalized in the media lately, to break away from the law in rejection of it is a result of the dominating culture that we have where we see powerful people up on high raining down upon us. And so we react to that by saying, hey, we want a piece of that power. We're going to do that too. It's a reaction to the system that we live in. And I think it comes from a very deep mistake in our culture where we don't recognize that we really aren't individuals. We really only exist in relationship to each other. We exist in our communities, and our strength comes from our communities. I don't think that individually we have the mandate nor the capacity to be self-governing on an individual level. So beyond these two questions, which are sometimes questions that we hear from even within sympathetic conversational groups. Beyond these, there will certainly be people who don't like these radical ideas and who don't want citizens to start thinking of themselves in this new and powerful way. There are powerful organizations whose members have very different ideas about who we are and what our position in this world is. And I suggest that our job is to confront that attitude in whatever form it manifests. This may sound a little bit scary, because in our culture, we generally are taught to avoid conflict. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've heard, just grin and bear it, just get it over with. Don't say anything, keep your head down. Some of us might even be hoping that that's what happens with our food sovereignty laws, that they'll pass and they'll be upheld with minimal conflict and no one will notice, and they'll have this magical effect of laws that we kind of give to laws where we think that it's like a magical protective spell, and then suddenly our whole community will be blanketed with protection and the inspectors won't be able to come in. That's clearly, as you can tell, a fantasy. That's not going to happen. And even if it did happen that way, it would be a lost opportunity. Losing the opportunity to have the discussion about the legitimacy of our laws and go into conflict with those who would argue that we don't have the right to do that is a missed opportunity. So what's the missed opportunity of conflict? When conflict is done right, conflict has the power to transform us. It has the power to transform our opponents. And because of that, because of our relational nature, conflict has the power to transform the society that we live in. That is our government. So conflict transforms us and our opponents because as we engage with conflict, we learn what our deepest values are. We learn about ourselves. As we engage with our partners in conflict, the so-called opposition, we're given the opportunity to learn from them and to adjust our views to the deeper truth that they also hold. There's also this trend in our culture towards cooperation and away from competition. And I think that this is healthy in many ways, but let's not go too far into a culture of just cooperation where we become pushovers and just say, yeah, yeah, whatever you want. There's something very healthy about that engagement, and it's why we value competition as a culture. Like, sports are so popular because competition tests our limits, it tests our dedication, it promotes knowledge of our own strengths and weaknesses, and it encourages creative problem solving. So when we engage in conflict, we learn and we come up with something better than if we just worked on it back in the corner and hope that nobody noticed. Conflict transforms our opponents because when we do conflict right, we don't miss an opportunity to engage. We have difficult conversations with people who disagree with us. We learn from them. We ask them questions. We hear what they have to say. We get to know their viewpoint. And simply being heard, having our viewpoints heard, and allowing other people's viewpoints to be heard is enough to take someone from a position of opposition or hostility to neutrality or even sympathy to our arguments. Viewpoints. I like viewpoint better. So because of this, because everyone who's engaging in conflict is transformed over time, the sum of all these conflicts has the power to transform our communities. Obviously, successful conflict transforms the issue at hand. Like, for example, here, the right to process chicken or sell raw milk without undue and costly licensing. Just for example. Oftentimes, though, the surface conflict is the symptom of a deeper disease of systemic injustice. And in our case, the symptom of undue regulations on small producers is a result of the deeper disease that big agribusiness and grocery industry has an inappropriate amount of power in our system of government. Also, in the course of confronting a conflict, we form relationships and we form alliances. And these alliances that are built wouldn't have been created otherwise if we hadn't been having these difficult conversations. So these connections will then outlive the immediate crisis. We'll become friends with people that we may never have met before. These are the basis for future support, and they're the basis for building an empowered and resilient populace. After all, we should remember that political labels are one of the biggest weapons used to divide us, and that when we can see this and go beyond and engage with human beings beyond their labels and as individuals, then we can put our political energy into the conflict that engages the unjust and illegitimate systems instead of into conflict that just makes us bicker with each other constantly to no avail. Conflict can also be transformative in our society by creating visible and understandable spectacles that frame the conflict for other people elsewhere. So the work that you're doing here can be inspirational to the people where I live, or the people in Oregon, or the people in Florida. We can show them that this is possible. More importantly, most importantly, in my opinion, is that confidently and competently engaging in conflict in a constructive manner is the means by which democracy is done. Talk about democracy being a doing. Democracy is mostly about talking, about finding solutions. We all have different viewpoints. We all have different goals. we will come into conflict with each other, no question. So to work together as a community, to listen deeply, and to talk through our differences will be the foundation of our success as a democratically controlled people. One of the things that's been very helpful to me is the work of Matt Gwynn and his religious peace organization, and they have codified the work of Martin Luther King, the steps of nonviolent conflict, nonviolent struggle, and the last step, the final step, is reconciliation, where both the opponents, the previous opponents, and the proponents both celebrate the victory because they have both realized that what was being fought for all along was beneficial to both of them. And then in the end, both parties are now a unified party that work together to enact and implement the change that everyone wants. So since I'm standing up here advocating conflict and saying that it's going to be the real blessing that transforms ourselves, each other, and our world, we should be very clear that conflict is something completely different from fighting. We have these words mixed up in our minds often. We can't stay in the old paradigm whereby half the society or a slightly higher majority of the society is dominated by the other or dominates the other. We can't do that. That will not accomplish change. When half win and half lose, we all end up with resentment and the pushing of the conflict underground through violence, and this inevitably bubbles back up. So in functional, transformational conflict, there's an emphasis on understanding. We listen very seriously to the words of Jesus Christ, who said, love your enemies, not don't have enemies, or don't talk to your enemies, or destroy your enemies. Love your enemies. Understand your enemies. See their humanity. We also choose not to cast our opponents as evil. We don't, like, love them from some high ideal, but really believe that they're damned. We don't let them off the hook in this way. We don't say, oh, they're a bad person, so let's forget about them. We hold them accountable to the goodness and ability to do right that is in them. There's an old saying that the only thing that's necessary for injustice to happen is for good people to do nothing. But I challenge that. And I would reword it, and I would say that the only thing that's necessary for injustice to happen is for the good people who are participating in injustice to go unseen and unsupported to reconsider their actions. Or again, to quote Dr. Martin Luther King, hate the sin and not the sinner. Work on the behavior, not the person. So another part of transformational conflict is that we come to it with a completely different attitude. We don't say, oh, I'm getting ready for a fight. We don't gird ourselves up and pump ourselves up. We react calmly, and we move into it with curiosity and openness instead of fear or anxiety or wanting to run away. We say, oh, great, here's an opportunity. What are we going to learn today? And the results of this changed attitude toward conflict might not be immediately apparent, might not work as a magic pill, snap our fingers. But the practitioner of transformational conflict has to be patient and have faith that their actions have planted seeds that need time to germinate and grow in the minds and hearts of their opponents. We also should recognize that conflict is really something beautiful that gives life meaning. Life is really more like a puzzle than anything else. And as we all know, the joy of doing a puzzle is in the doing of it. It's the most exciting when it's a confusing jumble and we get to apply our minds and our talents to putting it together. And then once it's done, it's kind of boring. And so then we take it back apart and start over again and find a new conflict to address and a new problem to work on. So we can have this sort of fun and engaged attitude with conflicts. Also, in transformational conflict, I'm not suggesting that we always smile and pretend like everything's okay. We can be authentic, and we can represent our strong emotions like anger or grief. Marshall Rosenberg, who wrote the book Nonviolent Communication, says that anger is our friend. It's an indication that something is wrong. When we feel angry, we can ask ourselves, ooh, what's happening to me here? It's like when our finger gets stuck in the door, we know we need to remove our finger from the door. Anger is telling us a similar thing. Our strong emotions can be powerful motivators. When we're upset about something, it can get us to the town meeting. It can make us engage in that conversation. But often, our response to our strong emotions is destructive and unfocused. Like, we show up at that meeting and start pointing fingers and yelling and accusing and placing blame. Violence or self-pity will not accomplish anything. Our reactions to our strong emotions should be directed towards concrete and measurable goals and requests. What are our needs that are being unmet, like our right to distribute and produce food that is nutritious? What step could be taken to meet that need? Well, we could remove these regulations. And how can we organize towards that end? Well, we can work together as a community to pass a law and then obey it. We can take concrete steps instead of just using that emotional energy to make a scene. And just like with organic farming, transformational conflict emphasizes the uniqueness of every context in which a conflict occurs, and it rewards our creativity instead of just learning some formulaic things to say. We're not robots. We have to use our full faculties. So whether we're at a public town hall meeting, or talking about a contentious issue with a neighbor, or at a friendly social function, or at home minding our own business, conflict will ultimately manifest as a face-to-face human interaction. It's very difficult to have a conflict with an idea unless that idea is being spoken out of the mouth of another person. So when these face-to-face human interactions happen, we should be ready with questions for that person and be ready to be open to a genuine interest in what they have to say. It's okay and even helpful to show people the depth of our conviction, to get a little worked up, and it's okay to show them the strength of our emotional ties to what we feel, because as emotional beings, that helps people understand that this is really important to us and we're not just, you know, reading out of the rule book. When we encounter these face-to-face interactions, it's so important. It's so important not to condemn the opposition and to always provide opportunities for them to respond positively to what we have to say and be open to the seemingly impossible that when we speak our truth, they might hear it and say, wow, I believe that too. I agree with you. We have to be open to agreement in order for conflict to be transformational. We create the space for that to happen. One of the ways that we create that space is by modeling respect towards the people. Respect means to see again. And when we encounter these people, we should see them as individuals with actions, personal actions and motivations, and not as stereotypes. It's so easy for us to see the people that we encounter as stereotypes, and that's a real blockage to transformational conflict. When we see people as individuals, we probably will realize that the conflict is not between the two of us. It's not a personal conflict. And then there is that space for reflection and change. Again, be patient and don't expect miracles. Hearing words of conviction and allowing someone to be heard has the possibility to shift a situation. It might just not happen in that very moment. It might be months down the line. So with all this talk about conflict, I want to be really clear that conflict and definitely fighting for their own sake are a waste of our lives, and they're definitely destructive. We're engaging with conflict consciously because we have a beautiful vision of what our world could look like. What is it that we're after? Well, here's what comes to my mind when I answer that question. I believe we're attempting to dissolve the false division between the people at the top and the people at the bottom, the big producers and the small consumers, the people governing and the people being governed. I'm trying to break that down, bring that back. Even in our wildest visions of food and political freedom, not everyone is going to be growing food for sale. But more and more people will get involved in the process and the economy. People will grow their gardens. They'll participate in CSAs. People will keep chickens or do work trade on the farms that they get food from. And not everyone is going to be running for elected office. But more and more people will be getting involved in the local political system by attending meetings, talking with officials, talking to each other, discussing issues and possible solutions, writing ordinances, and many other things. We can all be more involved in that. We can begin to see the creation of a culture where we are all producers and consumers of some kind, and we are all governing and governed at the same time. We participate in all of those things at the same time. And we're trying to create communities that are manifestations of local and regional culture And no one knows more about who we are here in our place than we do. Fundamentally, we're seeking to make a world where the people who are affected by decisions make those decisions, and as we struggle towards that vision, we learn how to make it happen. So, my final words about our real power in relationship to law and conflict and transformation of our government and society, beyond the words in the foundational documents and the theory of conflict that I described. Essentially, in reality, the truth is that we are all self-governing people already. We make hundreds and thousands of decisions every day about how to act, which laws to follow, and which laws to disobey. Sometimes those are, you know, real laws like speed limits and where we can throw our trash and what kind of, you know, thing we can put gasoline in. And sometimes there's social laws like etiquette and manners and, you know, the polite things that we do for each other to be kind. We make those decisions already. We're capable of making good decisions. We know that. Thomas Jefferson writes in the Declaration of Independence that to secure our rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the governed. And this is not a suggestion or a rhetorical flair. That is a reflection of actual fact. That's a reflection of our actual power and the truth. Our behavior, our consent, legitimizes the social contract of laws. The whole structure of law enforcement, as we know it, is focused on convincing us that it is better, safer, cheaper, more comfortable to obey laws than to disobey them, because the power of law comes directly from our obedience to it. There is no other power. It's words on paper. It's the energy that we give. From our inherent self-governing nature and the truth of our power, we can come together to create new laws that we feel more comfortable obeying, and we can give them power by obeying them. To respond quickly and authentically to the many crises that we face as a world, we require a radical and fundamental revitalization of democracy from coast to coast, from gulfs to Great Lakes, in fact, all around the world. Our collective power, when expressed locally, concentratedly, community by community, has the ability to overcome any obstacle. After all, if we believe in the dream of democracy, and I certainly do, it lives in me like a little fire that just won't be put out, then democracy must be expressed vibrantly and powerfully at the local level. The local level is the place closest to the source of all power, ourselves and each other. Thank you.
You've been listening to a talk given originally in April of 2016 in Bangor, Maine, on the importance of local self-governance and local food economies. For more information on creating local systems of authentic democracy and passing enforceable local ordinances, you can visit the website www.communityrightsgroundwork.org. Thanks for listening.